पशुवद्यवनैरेष नियमानस्वकं क्षयम् अन्वद्रवन् अनुपता शोचन्तो भृशमातुराः पशुवद्यवनैरेष नियमानस्वकं क्षयम् अन्वद्रवन् अनुपथाः शोचन्तो भृशमातुराः। पशुवाद्यवनैरेषा Ladies, please. Pashuvat, like an animal. Yavanaihi, by the Yavanas. Esha, Puranjana. Niyamanaha, being arrested and taken away. Swakam, to their own. Kshayam, abode. Anvadravan, followed. Anupathah, his attendants. Shochantah, lamenting. Bhrisham, greatly. Aturah, being distressed. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai. When the Yavanas were taking King Puranjana away to their place, binding him like an animal, the king's followers became greatly aggrieved. While they lamented, they were forced to go along with him. Purport. When Yamaraj and his assistants take a living entity away to the place of judgment, the life air and desires, being followers of the living entity, also go with him. This is confirmed in the Vedas. When the living entity is taken away or arrested by Yamaraj, tam utkramantam, the life air also goes with him, prano anutkramati. And when the life air is gone, pranam anutkramantam, all the senses, sarve pranaha, also go along, anutkramanti. When the living entity and the life air are gone, The lump of matter produced of five elements, earth, water, air, fire, and ether, is rejected and left behind. The living entity then goes to the court of judgment, and Yamaraj decides what kind of body he is going to get next. This process is unknown to modern scientists. Every living entity is responsible for his activities in this life, and after death he is taken to the court of Yamaraj, where it is decided what kind of body he will take next. Although the gross material body is left, the living entity and his desires, as well as the resultant reactions of his past activities, go on. It is Yamaraj who decides what kind of body one gets next in accordance with one's past actions. Om Ajnanatimirandasya Gyananjana Salakhaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare 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 Krishna. So I'd like to welcome all Vaishnavis and Vaibhav Prabhu and his wife. She's just first time stepped out of India to come straight to Chicago. So Hari Bol, welcome to Hare Krishna. So I was looking for this verse while we were reciting. This is from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And this doesn't work. Okay. So the situation is that King Puranjana is being forced out of his body, and he's being taken away, we could say mercilessly, by the attendants of Yamaraj. And he is bound like an animal. And all of the king's followers are greatly aggrieved. And Prabhupada tells us that when the soul, the living entity, is inhabiting a particular body, there are two types of bodies for that soul. One is subtle body, made of mind, intelligence, false ego. And there is a gross body, made of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And it is the false ego, primarily, that operates the subtle body and the gross body. Because depending on the false ego, the mind and the intelligence operate in a particular manner, giving rise to desires, aspirations, plans, all of that. And the gross body follows the dictates of the subtle body. So most people are so caught up in trying to understand who they are, and mostly it is gross body related, but that is not who we are. And the process of transmigration is that when one goes from this body to another body, the gross body is left behind, and the soul along with the subtle body passes on to the next gross body. So it's desires from its past life, the karmic reactions that are all stored in the form of kutam or tendencies are also passed along to the next body. So from a subtle perspective, there is continuity. From a gross perspective, there is discontinuity. This is a breakage. There is one body is left behind and they take on a new body. And the change is quite drastic. The change is so drastic that on the subtle platform, the mind and the senses, their configuration changes. So in the gross body, the senses, the configuration of the senses also change. So when we say senses, generally we say eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, like that. But these are with the gross body. The sense in general is also on the subtle platform. Just because someone doesn't have an eye or they're blind doesn't mean that the sense of vision is not there. It's there, except there is no instrument to perceive the gross elements. So this is one sense, and at a subtler level the sense exists. So all of that goes from one body to another body. And then the configuration in the new body of how the senses are grouped changes. So for example, in the human form of life, the two eyes, nose, ears, and nose and tongue are organized in this manner. In certain other animals, the eyes move laterally, the nose, there's a snout, the tongue, instead of being attached to the base of the throat, is attached to the front of the mouth, so the tongue opens up this way, like lizards and frogs, etc. Someone's mouth is, the human mouth is like this, the alligator's mouth is so big and organized differently, the hippo is different, the elephant is different, it's just very different. But the desires from the previous life carry on. And that's the subtle body is what decides the gross body. So behaviors, when they change on the external level, it doesn't necessarily mean that one is karmically relieved. Because anybody's behaviors can be forced to change. For example, the way certain people perform, we'll come back to devotional service, but in general, like we're going to talk about children tonight. So one of the things that parents try to do with children is force change of behaviors on the external level. You must do this, you must do this, like this, you should not do like that. And so the children, on an external platform, because they're either afraid of punishment or something, their behaviors change. But inside, their consciousness doesn't change. So when the time comes that they're either adults or they know that they can exercise their individuality, the first thing that they will do is leave those behaviors aside. Or in the army, for example, in the armed forces, whatever the superior says, the junior has to follow. And he has to say, "Yes, sir." Although internally he may be thinking, "What a fool. I don't have to follow this. This guy is just a, you know, get me out of here." And they will follow. All the orders that they are given, they will follow. It's a behavioral change. But internally, they may dislike the person thoroughly. So just behavior modification doesn't uplift or doesn't change or purify the subtle body. So what's important is for the karmic reactions to go away or for one's consciousness to be purified, the subtle body needs to be transformed. And the subtle body is transformed, as we know, through proper sound vibration and how we accept those sound vibrations. So in this case, when the soul is being taken away by the followers of Yamaraj, along with that goes the entire subtle body. It says, tam utkramantam, that is when the soul is being taken away, the life air goes along, prano anutkramanti. And then the life air is also gone, pranam anutkramantam, all the senses, sarve pranaha, also go along. So the sense of vision, the sense of hearing, the sense of taste, the sense of touch, all of those also get transferred into another body. But in the new body, the mind and senses have a different conception of identity, because it's according to the body that which, the gross body in which it will inhabit. So until now, a person may be thinking like a human being, because I have a human body. But my desires might not be human-like. My desires might be very animalistic. So as my subtle body is cultivating these desires that are animalistic, there is an incompatibility. My desires and my body don't match. I have an animalistic desire, set of desires. I have animalistic propensities, but my human body will not allow it to happen. Will not allow for those desires to be thoroughly, fully manifest. For example, I have a desire, let's say, to fly. I like to fly. I like to flap my hands and think that I will fly. So I might attach some appendages or something and try and try and try. But the body that I have right now cannot fulfill those desires, those aspirations. I need a body that will match what I'm carrying inside, or what the kind of conceptions and desires I'm holding on in my mind. So next body can be of a bird or an insect, the flies, however, depending on the other set of karmas that I have. Then I have a suitable body that allows me to fly. However, in this body I'm thinking, although I have these desires, my sense of identity is that I'm a human being. And as soon as this subtle body goes into the, let's say, body of a bird, vulture, let's say, I think of myself as a vulture. And the whole idea of what I consider food, what I consider family, what I consider friends in circles is all about vulture-like. This is how the false ego operates. And it is important, because if I remember, most people say, why don't I remember my previous life's activities? This is unfair. If I had remembered that in my previous life I was someone or something, then in this life I would not commit certain mistakes. The answer is no. If we remember, if we have a sense of identity from our previous life, then there is an identity crisis in this life. I don't know, am I a vulture or a human being? If I have good eyesight, maybe. If I can see from 2 miles away, oh. But the thing is, I should not be able to identify living bodies. I should be able to identify dead bodies. Then my vision is perfect. Oh, vulture. It creates an identity crisis. And creates a severe incompatibility. I don't know how I'm going to inhabit this body. So the false ego works very nicely. It completely removes the sense of identity from the previous body and gives us a full sense of identity with this body. And with each body comes a set of facilities. And at the time of death or after death, there is an accounting process, an audit. There is an audit. They look at, okay, you had this body, and with this body were all these facilities. Let us see whether you use these facilities or not. And how did you use these facilities? And after they go through all of it, they say, see, you were given all these nice facilities, and you did not use them, or you misused them, or you abused them, "Oh, I think you need a different body because seems like you want to behave like this when you should be behaving like this. So if you want to behave like this, here's a body. And in this body, you can behave exactly like this." Another principle is facilities are given, and when one doesn't use that facility, then the daivi arrangement, the higher arrangement is such that those facilities are taken away. So this is important as a human being or as whoever we are. According to who we are, there are certain facilities given. Like Prabhupada would say, that a clerk in the office and the CEO of the office, of the company, they have different facilities because they have different responsibilities. The greater the responsibility, the greater the facility. So the human form has the greatest responsibility. So it has the greatest facility. It has the facility for very refined intelligence. It has the facility for the very refined form of communication, language. The facility allows for us to study and discuss teachings from the Vedas, from the Bhagavatam. Has a refined sense of hearing. Now, refined sense of hearing just doesn't mean that, oh, I can hear subsonic or ultrasonic sound waves. Oh, my senses are refined. It means I can hear the Vedic mantras. I can absorb the Vedic mantras. I can understand and interpret the Vedic mantras. Not for some reason when we say the word interpret, you know, we get uncomfortable. Interpret means something is said and I understand it. So all these facilities are provided as an opportunity to upgrade ourselves. The upgrade is to have spiritual senses, spiritual body, spiritual mind, spiritual intelligence, spiritual existence. So the human form provides that facility, and along with it comes responsibility. Take care of it carefully. And there is, like here is described, there is judgment, like the Christian idea of judgment. At the end of life, you're taken to some place, and there is this grand old man with a flowing white beard and flowing robes, and he's called God. And he looks at you and says, "Have you been a good man?" "Yes." Boom. Heaven. "Have you been a good man?" "No." "Hell." "Heaven, hell, heaven, hell." And you will stay there eternally. That's not our concept. Similar, but that's not how we understand. The way the Vedas described is that within this world there are certain personalities who have the responsibility of adjudication. They decide. And they have certain parameters by which they decide. They have codes of behaviors. The Vedas provide the codes of behaviors. And they match how we live with those codes of behaviors. So it's the human being's responsibility to understand what are these codes of behaviors. Like they say, ignorance is not an excuse. "Oh, I did not know." Well, it's not an excuse. You should know. In the human form of life, one should know. Therefore the Vedas enjoin Athato Brahma Jigyasa. As soon as you've received a human body, your first duty is to inquire into higher dimensional subject matter, Brahma Jigyasa, into transcendental subject matters. So a child may say, "Well, I did not know. Nobody told me about it." Then the system says, "Yeah, but wherever you were born, whosoever family you were born into, they had that responsibility for you to set you on the path of transcendental knowledge. Parents, teachers, the spiritual master, the rest of the community. It is their responsibility. So someone might say, well then why am I being punished? My parents didn't do their job. So the Vedic system says, while that is true, still as a human being, you're supposed to inquire. You're supposed to inquire into subject matters as to why there is suffering. Is there God at all? How can I become happy? I'm seeing that people are trying to be happy, but they are not happy. Or they're happy for some time and that goes away. This is the proper use of the intelligence. But how Maya works is that it keeps the living entity very busy. It keeps the living entity so busy that they will not consider these questions. They send them to school for the first 25 years of their life. And in the school they have to learn all the things about chemistry, biology, physics, mathematics, trigonometry, algebra, civics, history, all science, all of that. And so people become very good experts at bits of information that really don't have too much value. In 1864, blah blah battle happened in some place, and in that battle these sets of people fought with those sets of people and something happened. History. Ah, what history. When I grew up, for me, straight 7 years, 7 or 8 years through high school history was all about Shivaji. Very centered around the place that I was growing, Maharashtra. I had no clue about the rest of history of India. I had no idea. I had no idea of what was happening in North India. Little Mughals, and because that Shivaji fought with the Mughals, I had some idea. I had no idea what was happening in South India. I had no idea of the history of Eastern India. And forget about anything that was happening in the world. What was happening in the rest of India came in high school history, when we talked about the freedom movement and how certain persons, the British, how they entered India, and from the British East India Tea Company, blah, 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 they took a... That was history. So one might say, what is wrong? These are important things. We are living in this world. Yeah, they may have importance, but they don't have ultimate importance. Ultimate importance is that every field of knowledge has to be connected to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is Narada Muni's instruction. So the real history is the Puranas, the Mahabharata, the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the real history. Because in this history, we learn the value of human life. In this history, we learn how great personalities have utilized the opportunities that they have. The study of biology, the study of mathematics, the study of physics and chemistry, etc., are meant for awakening a sense of appreciation of how Krishna's nature works. What is happening is all of these fields of education are separated from any theistic conceptions. Because nowadays in school you cannot use the word God. It's a crime. Because the moment you use the word God, you're put in a religions class. For example, now I don't want to get into this, but the whole idea of evolution. Some people say, oh, it's the chemical processes by which different species of life have evolved. Some people say, no, it's a creationist idea. It's God who created. Oh, hold on a minute. The moment you say God created, it has no place in science class. You'll have to discuss this in religion class. Because science means, come on, don't be a sentimentalist. Let's look at proper laws and how it's working. This is not the place for it. Take it to your religion class. You can teach in your Sunday school. God created this world. God has multifarious energies. He is called Krishna. That's nice for your Sunday school. When you come to school here, that won't work. You have to learn how these laws are operating. You have to be able to write all the formulas. How can you write a formula for God created the material world. You cannot write it. So here we think about things very objectively, very scientifically, empirically, like that. So knowledge has been separated from theism or from God. So what's the meaning of knowledge when it doesn't awaken God consciousness? It's not called knowledge, it's called nescience. This is what's discussed in Ishopanishad. Text 9, 10, 11. 9 and 10 specifically. Vidya and avidya. So in today's modern society, avidya passes away or is passed on as vidya. Ignorance is given the label of knowledge. Because despite all sorts of knowledge, the ignorance of our identity as Krishna's parts and parcels is completely missing. And this is why we say, or Prabhupada says, that the modern education system has failed its true purpose. Because the time, regardless of whether one is educated or a fool, educated means whether one has college degrees or not, this process still works the same way, whether one is an Indian or an American or Colombian or whoever. The process still works the same way. At the end of life, there is an audit. Let's see. You had this body, you had these facilities. How did you use them? You misused them. Or you've used them nicely. And you've used them in such a way that this awards you a spiritual body, spiritual existence. What we carry into our next body is all of our desires and conceptions and aspirations. So very important that as practicing devotees, it is very important that we don't execute bhakti just on the external platform of behaviors. External platform of behaviors means I put on a dhoti, a tilak, and I've perfected it. I know how, the first thing I've learned is the language, right? When someone is getting familiar with Krishna consciousness, the first transformation is the lexicon. We all learn the phrases. I'm fried, Prabhu, that is far out. I'm fallen. That's the favorite phrase. Sense gratification, maya. Under the modes, Prabhu, I'm resting. I'm resting, Prabhu. that's the phrase we use, I'm resting. We called you for Mangal Arati, we called you for all these programs. I was resting, Prabhu. Etc. We learn the phraseology very quickly. The next level of transformation is the dress. The dhoti comes on, the sari comes on, the kurta, and you know, one indication that our preaching is doing well is from our gift store, a lot of kurtas are sold. Oh, so transformation is happening. Rasika Manjushu told me, Prabhu, we need to order more kurtas. So those transformations happen at the bodily level. Internal transformation is more important. And that's where all these attachments are. The conceptions, the instructions, how are we following those? Is the internal, is the subtle body transforming? And that depends on the quality of our hearing and chanting, the sadhana program. That is where everything changes. So the real transformation is not in the dress only, is not in the language only, but internal. With what quality are we performing our hearing and chanting? With what quality are we performing seva to the Vaishnavas? That is what is going to make a big difference. In fact, that is what is going to make the difference. So as devotees, very important is to be very internally focused, cultivating the internal transformations of Krishna consciousness. That is how we use the facility of the human form of life. So yesterday we were hearing Jai Jagannath Prabhu saying that the tendency is to become ritualistic. The tendency is to become mechanical. Because mechanical means it's a habit that the body goes into. The real is the affective part. Why am I doing this? For whom am I doing this? Or unto whom am I doing this? Whose pleasure am I considering when I'm doing something? When I'm chanting or hearing or serving or even eating prasadam, whose pleasure am I thinking about? I mean, 99.9% of the times it's my own. But the 0.01% of the times that I consider that this is for Krishna's pleasure, this is for Guru's pleasure, those are the moments of transformations. When I was getting my first initiation, that Sunday night, there was a massive crowd here. And there was this roaring kirtan happening, and I was standing there, and Prithushava Prabhu was standing next to me, or I was standing next to him. And I said to him, "Oh, it's a big day for me." And he said, "See how Krishna's mercy works. Even if we accidentally chant one bead properly, look how far it can bring us." That set me into thinking. It's like, wow, among all the rounds we might have chanted, whatever sense of advancement is happening is that little spark of something that I might have considered purely. You know, even if I sat in somewhere and for a moment considered, I should really try to please my guru and I should really try to serve Krishna. Even that moment of consciousness is much more valuable than tons of external sets of behaviors where my heart is somewhere else. But I'm just doing something because, well, what will others think about it, or I should do this. So what to speak of where Krishna will take us or how close he will bring us to him when there is full absorption, or at least attempt, my dear Krishna, this is for your pleasure. Although I'm very far from anything that is pure, at least it's an attempt. Please accept this. Like that cultivation that we all can aspire for are the moments that help us transform the subtle body. Otherwise, just the gross body is transforming. And what happens at the time of death? Anyway, the gross body is discarded. It's in one sense the same trap we fall into that we caution, I will say, the materialists about. We tell the materialists, don't engage in temporary, mundane activities. Think about the soul. So we give the bird and the cage example. But as practicing devotees, if you're not alert in our application, we might do the same thing. Our behaviors change, but internally nothing has changed. So the external things at death or after death, all of that is discarded anyway. So in one sense, it still remains on the external material platform. And there is a lot of lamentation and aggrievement. So one wonders, what happened after years is still like that? And who laments? All the senses, all of the things that go along with the body, they're all in severe aggrievement and lamentation. The lamentation is, oh, I did not use my life properly. So final point, when Sri Madhavendra Puri was leaving his body, he also lamented, oh, I have not been able to remember Krishna. That lamentation is not this lamentation. That is a very high exalted state of bhava and prema. The lamentation that is coming from incomplete or ineffectual execution of bhakti sounds like the lamentation of bhava and prema, but they're not the same. Like the pure devotee of Krishna will think of himself as a very low, humble straw on the street. And a new bhakta can also say, I am very fallen. Both are not the same. One is a factual experience, another is a fashionable statement. Prabhupada, I am most fallen. And Prabhupada said, you're most nothing. Or one time there was a discussion and Prabhupada asked one of his disciples, you speak. How can I speak in the presence of Prabhupada? No, you should speak. Okay. And he spoke on the verse from Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, text 13. Mahatmanastumam partha daivim prakritimashritaha bhajanti ananya manaso gyatva bhutadimavyayam. And he said, sometimes we fall into maya. And there were about 4,000 people sitting in the crowd and Prabhupada interrupted. Sometimes you fall in maya, you're always in maya. Sometimes you think transcendental. I'm paraphrasing, but they corrected him. It's not like sometimes. Oh Prabhu, today I was afflicted by maya. Like that. So, final conclusion point is, or repetition is, great facilities have been awarded in the form of the human life. And for us, not only have we received human form of life, we have received all the necessary instructions of how to utilize the human form of life. This is Srila Prabhupada's greatest gift, a transcendental lifestyle, a transcendental set of association, subject matters to hear and discuss about, an object of our devotion, and the path. The path is pure devotees, devotional service, all of that's given. So the call to action is to fully utilize it, beginning with internal cultivation. Our Krishna consciousness is an inside-out process. Right? It's not an outside-in process. Outside-in means on the external platform I cultivate certain habits and behavior changes, but internally it may not happen. Inside-out. When there is transformation inside, transformation outside will come. That's the one that lasts. An outside-in transformation doesn't last. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabunaya Shravanadi Shuddha Chitta Kare Udaya. It's an inside-out process. And that inside-out process is started off by the process of hearing and chanting. Quality hearing and chanting. So anybody would like to add something? Questions, comments? Jai Jagannath Prabhu. Okay.
And you were giving the description of why I didn't know that we weren't trained to think in such a manner. And you were describing how the centers of nescience, in the form of academic institutions, keep us very inquisitive in the wrong direction, asking all the wrong types of questions. My question is, our acharyas speak quite heavily about such centers of nescience,
right,
and so on. But in the contemporary community of devotees, it seems to almost be somewhat frowned upon, especially if these things are spoken out in an open assembly, how we're being misled, how the educational institution is demoniac and all these things. Even though the acharya teachers are very strong in that direction. So I was wondering, especially if it is seen that a person wants to move away from such things, or they're very strongly speaking out against those things, then such a person may be branded or stigmatized as a fanatic. He's not broad-minded. He's not making a proper balance, etc. So I was wondering, how are we supposed to understand the very strong teachings of our acharyas against empiricism, and in a contemporary worldview where everyone's being encouraged to pursue, not everyone, but quite a few of our devotees are being encouraged to pursue right. such centers of nescience. How do we understand this properly? I know it's a little heavy question.
That's all right. I was going to, yesterday...
Because I get a lot of run for that.
I also get, sorry, don't worry. So you're not alone. Just that our ways of saying it might be a little different, but I get it too. Did you say like that to such and such? Did you say like that? There's one purport that I'd like to read, if you don't mind. This is short. If you don't, from my bag, the sixth canto is there. This is the story of Narada Muni preaching to the sons of Daksha, the 11,000 sons of Daksha. The first set of 10,000 sons, called the Haryashvas, were very obedient sons of their father. Father had told them, your 10,000 sons perform nice tapasya and have many, many children. Be a wonderful family, set of family men, 10,000 family men, thank you. So they were all very obedient and they were performing great austerities, and they met Narada Muni. And Narada Muni preached to them, what is the use of all these temporary activities? So all 10,000, they left their meditation and became sannyasis. Like how we've heard it is, that they joined Narada Muni's bhakta program. Daksha was very upset. What is going on? So he had another 1,000 sons called the Shavalashvas. And he told them, go and perform proper meditation. Be like me. I'm Daksha. Prabhupada describes, Daksha means very expert. In this case, he said, Daksha is very expert at having sex, he says. He says, you should also become like me. Have many children. My service is to propagate population in this universe. You should help me do this. Yes, my dear father. So they went to the same place where their brothers had gone. And guess what? Narada Muni met them there also. And he told them, shouldn't you be following your older brothers? Because a younger brother who doesn't follow the older brother is actually ungrateful to his older brother. Oh, really? So they also left and joined his bhakta program. Daksha became very upset. And he came and he met Narada and he chastised Narada Muni. Okay, so here's what he said. Prajapati Daksha said to Narada Muni, Daksha was very angry at Narada and he almost fainted due to lamentation. When Daksha met Narada, Daksha's lips began trembling in anger and he spoke as follows. Alas, Narada Muni, you wear the dress of a saintly person, but you are not actually a saint. Indeed, although I am now in grahastha life, I am a saintly person. By showing my sons the path of renunciation, you have done me an abominable injustice. My sons were not at all freed from their three debts. This is a very common argument that parents give their children. You have debt, not only financial debt, but you have debt. The debt is, we have done so much for you, and it is your responsibility to, it is your duty to do this. Find a job, become a family man. I'm not saying that everyone has to reject, but that's what the indoctrination is. My sons were not freed from their debts. Indeed, they did not properly consider their obligations. O Narada Muni, O personality of sinful action, you have obstructed their progress towards good fortune in this world and the next, because they are still indebted to the saintly persons, the demigods, and their father. Prajapati Daksha continued, thus committing violence against other living entities and yet claiming to be an associate of Lord Vishnu, you are defaming the personality of Godhead. You needlessly created a mentality of renunciation in innocent boys. And therefore, you are shameless and devoid of compassion. How could you travel with the personal associates of the Supreme Lord? Etc. So in this, there's a purport. I want to read. This is purport to Canto 6, Chapter 5, Text 36. Sometimes a saintly person is misunderstood by grihasthas, especially when he instructs their young sons to accept Krishna consciousness. Generally, a grihastha thinks that unless one enters grihastha life, he cannot properly enter renounced life. If a young man immediately adopts the path of the renounced order in accordance with the instructions of Narada or a member of his disciplic succession, his parents become very angry. The same phenomenon is occurring in our Krishna consciousness movement because we are instructing all the young boys in the Western countries to follow the path of renunciation. We allow grihastha life, but a grihastha also follows the path of renunciation. Even a grihastha has to give up so many bad habits that his parents think his life has been practically destroyed. We allow no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling, and no intoxication. And consequently, the parents wonder how, if there are so many no's, one's life can be positive. In the Western countries especially, these four prohibited activities practically constitute the life and soul of the modern population. Therefore, parents sometimes dislike our movement, just as Prajapati Daksha disliked the activities of Narada and accused Narada of dishonesty. Nevertheless, although parents may be angry at us, we must perform our duty without hesitation because we are in the disciplic succession from Narada Muni. Does that answer your question? Correct. Therefore, the tone of today's presentation was, it's important that the transformation is internal and not external. Not that I have a set of behaviors now because I'm a devotee, but internally I'm still harboring the desires of this or money or fame or whatever. And it's not that everyone has to join Brahmacharya Ashram. That's not the point. In fact, I should not say that. Everyone should join. Because it's important to be trained properly. Then one can decide, according to one's nature, that marriage is better for me or this is better for me. Without that, imagine what the world of devotees would look like if the young men and young women moved into family life or work life without proper training of consciousness. Oh, the training is of consciousness as to how to see everything as Krishna's property. Like we were discussing yesterday. The first principle of Brahmachari life is everything belongs to my guru. It doesn't matter what it is, everything belongs to my guru, except criticism. Criticism belongs to me. But everything else belongs to guru. The food that I beg, the money that I beg, everything is guru's property. That's what a Brahmachari is first trained in. The second is trained in celibacy. When Daksha is saying that there are three debts that my sons haven't fulfilled, the debt to the saintly persons, the debt to the demigods, and the debt to their father. So Prabhupada explains in the purport that a young man is trained in these three principles so he can relieve himself of the debt. His debt to the saintly persons is relieved by his celibacy. His debt to the demigods is relieved by performing Vedic sacrifices. And it says the debt to his father is relieved by continuing progeny. If they don't have progeny, then the Pinda ceremony doesn't happen. Therefore, they should have, like that. And then Prabhupada quotes this verse, that one who is fully surrendered unto Krishna is relieved of all his debts to the demigods, the saintly persons, the forefathers, all of that he is relieved. So that internal transformation of what is bhakti? Anyway, I was going to say something about marriage. Anyway, I'll say it. I'll be not popular, that's all. This will not be the first time. For example, when a young man who's, let's say, practicing Krishna consciousness has to marry, what are the considerations that he should go through? Generally, here the considerations that they go through: is the girl from my caste? Is the girl same language that I speak? Is it from... The Bhagavad Gita begins with Dehinosmin Yatha Dehe. And Prabhupada's every teaching is, you're not this body. I'm not American, I'm not Indian. And as a practicing devotee, the first consideration someone will make is he or she my language, my caste, my... So first principles itself, the teachings haven't fully internalized. I'm not saying that there may be other reasons, but the considerations that one has to go through. That means something internally hasn't shifted. Because we still look at, oh, this girl is American, this boy is American, I'm someone else in the house. What's important is devotee, whether or not the person is a devotee. You can ask, you can qualify. He's not a strict devotee, he's not a like this devotee, I don't want to marry. That's different. For example, because I'm using it without much explanation, but you get the idea. Any other comments, questions? Yes, Mataji. Online? Ankit Vora? Okay. Haribol, Ankit. We were just thinking about you the other day. Is the mic?
So he says, Hare Krishna Prabhu, if one performs devotional service to Krishna and takes part in Sankirtan movement, but somehow cannot remember Krishna at the end of life, Krishna states that his endeavors will not go in vain and he will start from where he ended. But when he comes back to Earth, planet, and don't find Sankirtan movement on Earth, can he still go back to Krishna, Golok Vrindavan?
This is a university student question. But it's thoughtful. Well, the question assumes so many things, so it's difficult to answer. It assumes that the person will be born in Kali Yuga. It assumes that at that time there will not be Sankirtan movement. It assumes that the process of bhakti will not be there. I mean, it assumes many things. And it's not necessarily like that. It also assumes that we have understood how this process of transmigration works. When Yamaraj is making these arrangements, for a devotee, Yamaraj is not part of the game plan. He is not deciding which person goes where. The whole set of rules that govern the devotee are different from Yamaraj's rules. So when Krishna has promised that devotional service will continue, then we accept that it will continue. Krishna will provide us a perfect environment. Even if in the whole world there is no Harinam Sankirtan, he will provide us an environment where our hearing and chanting can happen. So that's not a worry. Will that happen? Yes. If the material energy is working with such predictability, then what to speak of Krishna's? So the question has many assumptions. And the simple answer is, yes, it will work. Yes, not to worry. Yes, Balram Prabhu. Hare Krishna.
So after death, we hear that Yamaraj, we're taken to the court of Yamaraj, and then he gives us a new body according to our past activities.
Right.
So does this only excluded to human life, or is every living entity, no matter what species of life, after their death, are they taken to the abode of Yamaraj, and then according to their activities? Are they given a new body, or is it only because due to the human life?
Only because of human life.
Right, because we hear the animals aren't accounted for their sinful activities.
Well, the animals don't perform sinful activities.
Right.
Okay. Animals just perform activities because they have a body. The idea of sinful is because the human being has intelligence to consider the consequences of his anger. A tiger does not attack without a reason. Human beings do like that. So the consequence, that's why the class was about responsibility and how one lives those responsibilities or facilities. So the only human beings are judged, not animals. Within the other species of life, there is a natural progression towards the human form of life. Is that okay? Yes, Siddharth Prabhu. Hold on. I can't hear. Can you flip it on, please?
These centers of nisense, some of these actually teach empiricism, but some of them also teach pragmatism. So practically speaking, they are the centers which produce the Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras.
No, they're the centers that produce Shudras. They're not centers that produce Kshatriyas. Sorry.
Or whoever outside.
Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says differently. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that modern education systems render a person like an ass, a beast of burden. Because Brahmana, the definition of Brahmana is not just intellectual, but a Brahmana who is charitable and a Brahmana who is teaching people transcendence.
I'm not saying that they produce Brahmanas, definitely not, but at least they produce people who could support Brahmanas. So why should we have hostile?
No, I don't think we have hostile. We're talking. We're discussing. We're not saying to any of these young people here, or any young people online, or their parents sitting here, we're not saying to them or anyone that there should be a mass exodus from the universities because, hey, you're all becoming asses. I don't think that's the message. That's not the message at all. The message is there an internal cultivation happening, and as members of society, as parents, are we facilitating that internal cultivation? And are we supporting that internal cultivation? Just so that when we are in a university system, that we don't become a Shudra mentality, that we cultivate a higher mentality. That's what we're saying. We're not saying mass exodus. In fact, in some cases, an exodus is a good thing because their nature may not be like that. So the question for us to consider is, are we educating our children according to their natures or not? When we went through school, I don't think it was considered. What's my nature like? Because everyone goes to school, you should also go to school. Everyone is doing engineering, you should also do engineering. My nature was just not like that. But I also did engineering. Everyone is doing this. What will you do? After that, you have to get a job. like that. So are we thinking, are we paying attention to what is the nature of my child? What is it that about their nature will make them happy? But it's mixed with what will make me happy, what are my worries, what if tomorrow if my son or daughter, you know, is struggling for money because, you know, they dropped out or something. It may be my worry. It may also be my inability to cut the cord and let my child live their life as responsible young adults. Because I did what I could do, and are they doing it or not? I think the discussion, at least my intention of the discussion, is to make ourselves more thoughtful. I'm not proposing or demanding exodus.
So do you think this is a problem just with public schools? Because I don't know if you could call them religions, but some religions have their own communities, their own schools, where their scriptures are also given a priority. Is that an exception to this? Or?
I can't say, because it will be a general statement, like a sweep statement, and I don't think that will be accurate. But the general idea is, children should learn something about God. But that's not our process. Our process is not, at school you become a competitive, fierce, cutthroat personality. But when you come to Sunday school, oh God, some song you sing and some bhajan you sing. Some Monday through Friday, you're indoctrinated. Go out there, conquer the world, be the number one. When you come to Sunday school, samsara das. That's not our process. It's not a secular... That's the fundamental Krishna consciousness. We're not secular religion. We don't compartmentalize our life. Everything is the service of Krishna. How we are out there in the workplace, how we are at home, how we are in the market, how we are in the temple, everything is pervaded by service to Krishna. That's the important lesson. Is that okay? Okay, I get emphatic. Yes, Rajiv. Nature of child. How do you get the nature of child?
How do you judge the nature? My daughter Anushi, how would I judge her nature?
See, he didn't say Ankit. He's gone. Gone case. Ankit, gone case. Which I agree. Anushri is still, we can save Anushri. To know the nature of a person, one should first know, suppose I have to... Suppose I have to teach Anushri quadratic equations in algebra. And if I don't know what that is, then she'll be looking at me and I'll be looking at her and wondering what to do. So my first lesson is I need to know what is quadratic equations before I can teach her. Right? So to know the nature of our children, we first need to know what are the natures. What is the nature of a Brahmana? What is the nature of a Kshatriya? What is the nature of a Vaishya? What is the nature of a Shudra? We need to understand that clearly. That's number one. Second, our natures don't manifest just like that, because most of it is mixed with passion and ignorance. So a proper sadhana program is necessary. And in that sadhana program, by proper purification, our natures will manifest. Then occupation according to nature is provided. So the actual Vedic system was that the student goes to the Gurukula, a little away from parents for a particular reason actually. Because when the parents are there, then the children become very, my parents. So when they have someone else other than the parent as a teacher, I have this experience. So in the teacher's house or wherever the teacher, from age 5 to 25, they're just taught proper purificatory methods. And in the course of those 20 years, the teacher understands, oh, this person's nature is this, this person's nature is this. And they're given services and engagements according to those natures. But our education system, unfortunately, puts everyone into this same bucket. And the same bucket is everyone has to come out ready for jobs. One thing, one after the other, one after the other. You want some variety? You can take accounting, you can take science, you can take engineering, you can take something. That's the variety you get. But the nature is everyone should find a job. Some will say, well, what to do? We have come into such a system. Without a job, we cannot live. That is true. We are in such a situation where the entire system around us has come to such a stage. And guess what? If we don't do something now, the Kali Yuga proper gets much worse in the future. I'll be bold and say it, I hope. Somewhere deep down, and I'm not saying in your case, so it's not you, I'm now speaking general. Somewhere deep down, it may also be that we may not have confidence in the whole process of Krishna consciousness. We may not have confidence in what the institution can do for us. We may not have confidence, will Krishna really take care? Perhaps. And so it's not about the children, it's about us. And now I'm speaking as parents, not about you particularly. Yeah, Shruti. Man. Hold on.
I was wondering if you could speak about the importance of education for women specifically, because I was thinking, like, for men at least who want to enter Grihastha Ashram, there's a need for them to study properly because they have to get a job and maintain their family. But even with that, there's a danger because it could distract you from the purpose of life. So for women, it almost doesn't seem necessary. So I've been having trouble like understanding Whoa. The connection.
So first I'll speak Vedic system. In the Vedic system, continuing from Rajiv Prabhu's question, natures and occupation were always matched. Along with the nature and occupation, genders and occupation were also matched. Because according to gender is one's capacity and facility. Right? So let's say a soul in a woman's body. A soul in a woman's body has certain gross facilities, like a womb that can nurture a child. Along with that comes the subtle facilities, very nurturing, caring, emotionally very astute, etc. This comes as part of being in a feminine body. So when those qualities are matched with occupations, then it is said to be very satisfying. So yes, to direct your questions, yes, it's not necessary. The kind of education women were given is very different from the kind of education men were given. Because their roles are different, their natures are different, their functions are different. So the women mostly were trained in the subtler aspects of life. How to make children emotionally stronger. How to make children think about subtler things in life, like compassion, sensitivity, proper speech, etc. That was the training. But in the modern system, everything's been mixed up thoroughly. I mean, I'm not against this or that, I'm just saying. So in the modern system, there's this urge, this pressure. No, equality of rights, equalities of... But our Vedic aphorism is that all living beings are not created equal. They're not. Because if you say all are created equal, you have completely dismissed the whole karma theory, the whole karmic process. Why is a soul in a woman's body? Why is a soul in a man's body? There's a difference there. Functions are different. Physiological functions are different. The biological functions are different. The karmic functions or sociological functions are very different. So when one is educated according to one's nature, one becomes happy or satisfied. Because when one is satisfied, one can think of Vishnu. That's the idea. But the dissatisfaction is when nature and occupation don't match. Is that okay? Because it's being recorded.
As women, should we be giving more importance to this over-education?
Absolutely. Okay. Not that, you know, some may have aspirations. While that is there, more important is the subtler. Because life has a particular function, a role that is coming up. And that's a more important role as women. Arjuna's main argument was if women are not trained properly, the future generation of children are not trained properly. Yeah? Okay. Nice question. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Every Saturday it's becoming a ritual that I don't want to do. So we will meet downstairs. For